Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. If Seattle changed some single-family zoning to apartments and condos, would that make housing cheaper or not? Would it be worth changing the character of this city? We're going to have that debate coming up on the show. I hope you can stay tuned. Our first story, the Seattle Mariners second baseman Robinson Cano is going to have some extra time to recover from his broken hand because yesterday Cano was suspended for half a season for violating the league's drug policy. What does this mean to a Mariners fan and anyone who cares about fair play? My guest is the managing editor of the Miami New Times, Tim Elfrink. 5 years ago, he broke the story of baseball. Last big steroid scandal, the South Florida Wellness Clinic that was supplying human growth hormone to major leaguers. Tim, welcome to KUOW.
Thanks for having me.
Robinson Cano was suspended for taking a diuretic called furosemide. He points out it's not actually a performance-enhancing drug, so why is he not fighting his 80-game suspension?
Well, because his statement doesn't tell the full story, which he's absolutely right. This drug alone, this diuretic, actually isn't enough to get suspended by Major League Baseball. It is banned in the sport, but if they catch you taking it, they also have to prove that you were taking it to try to mask a performance-enhancing drug like a steroid. And basically, Major League Baseball had to do some detective work after he failed a test for this diuretic, and apparently they were able to get enough evidence that he was taking it to mask a steroid or another banned substance, that he didn't have any choice. He had to accept the case. So I think his statement is pretty disingenuous, the way he's tried to frame the case.
So not fighting a suspension, is that a tacit admission of guilt that, yeah, I did take a performance-enhancing drug?
Well, it's hard to see why else he would drop the case, because he apparently failed the initial test for the diuretic in the off season before the season actually began. And he did appeal the case at that point. So between now and then, Major League Baseball has gotten some sort of evidence to convince him that fighting this wasn't going to be worth his time.
Robinson Cano is halfway through one of the richest contracts in all of pro sports, $240 million over 10 years. What incentive does he have to take a banned substance?
Well, that's a great question, you know, and I think a lot of people, when they think of steroids, imagine guys trying to bulk up their numbers to get a giant contract, and that's not Robinson Cano. He already had his payday. He's got years left on this contract. So I think it actually causes you to ask some larger questions about his career and how he got to that point of getting that payday, because, you know, these are extremely competitive guys, and, you know, if it's a case where maybe he got this performance in the first place by relying on some of these drugs, or, you know, maybe it's a case where he's 35 years old now. You know, the body starts to fade, injuries start to pile up. There's a lot of reasons the guys turn to these kind of drugs, especially when they're as competitive as somebody like Robinson Cano, who's really been putting up close to Hall of Fame numbers across his career.
But he's not one of these home run titans. I remember the baseball steroid scandal of 20 years ago or so. It was Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa hitting 70 home runs or something. But Robinson Cano is not that.
That's exactly right. And, you know, it's a different era of performance-enhancing drugs in 2018 than it was during the great home run race, where you had these guys with monstrous bodies who looked like they stumbled out of a gym somewhere.
Right.
You know, now if you look at Major League Baseball's banned substance list, there are more than 70 performance-enhancing drugs on that list. And a lot of them you don't take to bulk up or get enormous to hit 90 home runs. They're drugs that help you recover more quickly. They help you deal with just the wear and the tear of the season and get an unfair advantage in how quickly your body bounces back. You know, they give you slight advantages instead of monstrous advantages that might be especially obvious to drug testers. So there's a lot of reasons to take these kind of substances beyond just hitting home runs.
So how widespread do you think the use of banned substances actually is in the major leagues?
Well, look, as long as the incentives are there, and they definitely are there, to try to get some kind of advantage over, you know, your competitors in a sport, they're going to be guys who try to evade the system. You know, Major League Baseball has the strongest testing policies of any of the major sports in the U.S., mostly because they've been whacked so hard over these major scandals like Balco and Biogenesis over the years. So it's difficult. It's not easy to do, and I think there's certainly less guys doing it as obviously as they were in the 90s before there was any real testing in place. But, you know, Cano is just the latest reminder that doesn't mean that the drugs are gone out of the sport. I think it's still, fairly prevalent as long as the incentives are there to try to beat the system.
For example, you know, I think a lot of sports fans want to know whether their team is the good guy or the bad guy or something else. And the Mariners have Nelson Cruz served a 50-game ban in 2013. D. Gordon served an 80-game ban, I think it was, in 2016. So would you guess that the Mariners are they're probably typical when it comes to performance-enhancing drugs, or we can't tell? How should a Mariner fan think about how much their players are cheating?
I wouldn't get too down on yourself as a Mariners fan. I think that's a pretty dangerous game to play, to assume that you're rooting for a clean team, because there's really no way to know across an entire squad. And if you work out the law of averages, you're bound to have a couple guys that are probably trying to evade the drug testers, no matter who you're rooting for.
So you said that you brought up the idea that maybe Robinson Cano didn't start taking performance-enhancing drugs in the middle of his career, of his huge contract. Maybe he got the contract because he'd already been juicing. Is that what you're saying? And if so, do you think this makes baseball and fans reconsider Robinson Cano's entire career? Maybe he's not a future Hall of Famer even.
Well, look, I think you have to ask the question, because he's now in a small subset of great players who have actually failed performance-enhancing drug tests. You know, I think Hall of Fame voters are already asking that question, you know, about guys like Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens, who actually never failed tests. You know, there's a lot of evidence out there that they were juicing. But Cano has now failed a test. He's gotten an official suspension. And I think, you know, you're not really thinking about the big picture if you don't ask a question about his full career. And, in fact, TJ Quinn over at ESPN, he's pointed out that Cano's name actually came up during the Biogenesis investigation. He was never linked in any substantial way to the clinic in a way that MLB could prove there was anything going on. But, you know, he was on the Yankees at the same time as A-Rod. He was connected to a lot of the guys that were proved to be going to the clinic. And I think he was a guy Major League Baseball kept an extra close eye on as a result of that. So, you know, who knows? We may never know the answer to that, but I think it's a question you have to ask now that he's actually failed a test.
By the way, people who lived in Seattle for a while will recognize the name A-Rod. Alex Rodriguez played here early in his career and then ended up in New York and, among other things, caught up in this Biogenesis scandal.
That's exactly right. And it's the same question I think people have to ask about Rodriguez's career. You know, he's only admitted to have taken steroids during a few periods of his career, you know, coincidentally the periods he got caught taking steroids. But I think a lot of people assume his drug use went much further back to that, including potentially his time in Seattle. So, you know, similarly with Robinson Cano, will we ever get an answer to that question? I don't know, but I think it's a question you have to ask now that he's failed the test.
Again, this is the managing editor of the Miami New Times, Tim Elfrink, who broke the story of that big steroid scandal 5 years ago, that South Florida clinic shooting up players. And I always wondered this, when Robinson Cano has served his half-year suspension and he comes back, will he still be extra good because of whatever he's already taken? Will the Mariners be benefiting from his performance-enhancing drug use after he's served his time?
You know, it's so hard to know, especially not knowing exactly what Robinson Cano was taking. You know, I talked to somebody at Major League Baseball today, and they're not expecting to release, you know, whatever information they have about what he was taking beyond this diuretic. Obviously, they have evidence he was taking something else, but we may never know what he was actually on.
Right.
And when it comes to these drugs, it's an interesting question, the level of the benefit they get from them. You know, I talked to people after the Biogenesis scandal broke who thought that for some of these guys, a lot of it was almost a placebo effect, that, you know, they're sort of taking these very small doses to try to evade the tests. And it's not even clear exactly how much of a physical benefit you get from that, as much as they felt like they were getting an advantage and having a step over everybody else on the field. So if that's taken away from somebody like Robinson Cano, maybe that has an effect on how aggressively he approaches the game or his mentality. It's really hard to say, but it'll play out on the field whenever he does return.
Tim, just one or two more questions. One of them is, how should a fan feel? You know, you come to a baseball game, you come to Safeco Field or wherever, and you want to think that you are seeing the best of the best on a level playing field. Is it actually more like you're seeing the best of the juicers against the rule followers who are at a disadvantage? I mean, is there anything fair about going to a baseball on a summer day and watching?
Well, it's a complicated question, and I think there is a discussion to have about just how fair the regulations are, if we're sort of being, you know, there's a level of hypocrisy in pretending the game's ever really been clean. But I do think one thing that is fair to look at a fan from a fan's perspective is that players like Robinson Cano, they know what the rules are. You know, it's not a mystery what's banned and what's not. And to me, what always upset me the most, because I am a lifelong baseball fan, is it's the dishonesty. You know, it's Alex Rodriguez looking in the camera and just saying repeatedly that he has never taken steroids, and, you know, claiming that he had never met Tony Bosch, the owner of Biogenesis. And, you know, the dishonesty is to me hard to get past. And I think if you talk to anybody in Major League Baseball who understands the rules and what Robinson Cano was suspended for, the statement he put out yesterday is pretty dishonest on its face. He doesn't seem like a guy who's owning up to what's going on here. So to me, I would be almost more upset at that than at the bigger picture of the drug issue.
Okay, then that does bring me to one final question. If what bothers you, Tim, is the dishonesty, how would you feel about just saying, game on, drink your coffee, take your whatever that performance-enhancing drug is, whatever you put in your body is your business, and go out there and do your best?
Well, we've sort of lived through that era, right? I mean, that really was the 90s in Major League Baseball. There was no testing and, you know, Bud Selig.
But if all the fans knew that, who knows what they're taking? Who cares? Play the game. How would that be better? Then there wouldn't be the dishonesty you don't like.
Yeah, to me, it's not the solution I would look for. I think it's an argument worth having, especially because the science is constantly evolving so much that the testing becomes this sort of Swiss cheese policy that sometimes is more of a PR campaign than an actual, way to catch the cheaters involved. But I do think, you know, would I like to see a player who gets caught stand up and say, I took steroids because I was going to make more money from taking them, and that's the reality of the game. I'm sorry I got caught, but that's why I took them. That would be pretty refreshing. I mean, I think that fans might even be a lot quicker to forgive someone like that.
We've been talking about this with the editor, managing editor, Miami New Times, Tim Elfrink, and the book he wrote about that scandal was called Bloodsport. He's the co-author of a book called Bloodsport, Alex Rodriguez and the Quest to End Baseball's Steroid Era. And obviously, the era of performance-enhancing drugs is not over. It's not over for Robinson Cano and the Mariners. Tim, thanks a lot.
The quest continues. Thanks for having me.
The quest continues. You're listening to The Record on KUOW. Coming up, should Seattle build upward? Stay tuned. It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. The city of Seattle has just passed a new head tax on businesses. Some of the money will pay for homeless services, but most of the money will pay for building about 600 units of affordable housing over 5 years. 600 units, that's a fraction of the demand for cheaper housing. If you really want to lower home prices, says the Chamber of Commerce, Seattle needs to build upward. We are a city zoned mostly for single-family houses. The Chamber says we need to let developers turn craftsmen into apartments, condos, townhomes. But wait, is that the city we want? Would that be the city we love? Here with two different points of view, we have Roger Valdez. Roger, will you remind me how I should identify your work?
I'm the director of Seattle for Growth.
Director of Seattle for Growth. You're in favor of upzoning, being less of a single-family housing town.
Right. And I mean, how we're a housing advocacy organization, all kinds of housing everywhere for people of all levels of income.
All kinds of housing everywhere. Susanna Lynn, welcome.
Hi.
You live in Wallingford?
I do.
And you are against this idea of upzoning, significantly upzoning Seattle.
Yes, I don't think the plan will work to make Seattle more affordable.
So let's begin. You live in Wallingford, as I said. Roger, let's say I used to date somebody in Wallingford. I can picture it. some relatively quiet streets and lawns and rhododendrons in the front yard. She happened to have a driveway, but I guess I don't know if all homes do. But I can picture this single family Seattle neighborhood. Roger, what do you, you said housing everywhere. What do you want that area of Wallingford I'm picturing? How do you want Susanna's neighborhood to be like?
Well, I think it ought to be determined by the property owners and the people that live there and the people that want to live there. So I don't necessarily want to see the neighborhood change overnight, but I think property owners, single family homeowners, should be able to create, you know, a backyard cottage or create a duplex or a triplex and allow more people to live in Wallingford. I think if you keep it single family, it means that you've got you create scarcity and only a certain number of people can live there. So my point is not so much, you know, wipe out the single family, but give the single family homeowners more options to build on their own property.
So, Susanna, imagine those backyard cottages and duplexes and triplexes on your Wallingford street. What would that do to your neighborhood, in your opinion?
So I have no problem with backyard cottages. I think they're a great way to add a little density. And as far as duplexes and triplexes go, the concern is what would that look like as far as setbacks and a lot of the properties we see now that are multifamily take up a lot more room. But a lot of what I'm getting at is that I don't think this is going to help the affordability. And I also think that there's plenty of room right now with our current zoning. And so first use the room we have, which is 2 to 3 times what we need to build the housing that we're projected to need. So first use that current zoning that we have and that the neighborhood has planned, in our old neighborhood plans as to where the density would fit best.
Okay, so those are two arguments. Let's break those down. First of all, you said you don't believe that building more, that upzoning Seattle and building more units would make housing more affordable. I remember Econ 101, the more supply there is, the cheaper it gets. Why do you say that wouldn't happen in Seattle?
Okay, so real life is rarely textbook.
Yes.
Yes. So let's take a look at some place like the Central District. Okay, the Central District is a historically black neighborhood with, you know, historically people who might not be as wealthy as other neighborhoods. And part of the argument with the upzoning is that increased density is going to make it cheaper. So the Central District has had a lot of increased density, but what is happening is they're increased luxury units, and the most affordable units is what is being torn down first.
Okay.
And so, you know, it's not helping. The increased density we see in the Central District is not helping people of color or poorer communities thrive.
Roger, if the new housing units are fancy and expensive, how does that make housing cheaper?
Well, that's just not true. I mean, there's something called the skew of the new. So when, just like buying a new car is more expensive than buying a used car. So when we build new housing, that new housing is more expensive because it's new. But overall, if we create more, and we've seen it in New York right now where there's a drop in rents because there's an abundance of supply. When there's scarcity, prices go up. The data shows over years that for about 40,000 units created over a 20-year period, there were only about, I think it was 5,000 demolitions. So we're creating a 8-to-1 ratio of new housing to housings that we're knocking down. And so if you knock down an older single-family house in a low-rise zone and build 40 units or 50 units, the net value to the community exceeds the loss of that one unit. So overall, what we're seeing is more supply means lower prices, and it means more access to housing for all kinds of people.
Okay, so that's a fundamental disagreement that we're not going to convince listeners of one way or the other sitting here in a studio, but that's there's a framed debate for you. Would more housing make units cheaper? And we don't have agreement on that. We have an email from a KUOW listener named Tom in Finney Ridge. And Tom writes, by the way, our email address is record@kuow.org. Tom in Finney Ridge writes, if the council decides to pack the neighborhoods and remove yards where kids can play and plants can flourish, we might as well be Manhattan with all its attendant issues. Short answer is, says Tom, saving the neighborhoods is key to saving the city, because when, not if, the crash comes, all those ugly square buildings that have replaced the houses and yards will be vacant, and there will be no coming back to where we were or are now. Roger, how do you answer that?
Well, we're a city. So, you know, if you want to live in, you know, Mount Vernon, then move to Mount Vernon. We're going to have issues. And the fact is that as a city that's growing, we're going to have more diversity. We're going to have more complex issues as when you got more people in the same place.
But we don't have to, right? I mean, we could vote to preserve the Seattle exactly like some people love it. Maybe
that's why Susanna came here. Well, but we have a city council that talks out of both sides of its mouth. On the one hand, it talks about sustainability and density and benefit to the environment from living in a more dense, compact, walkable environment. But then they do things to undermine that with their policy to make it harder to build. So sure, put it on the ballot. You know, pull up the drawbridge and shut down the city and don't let anybody else come in. If people vote for that, I guess that's what we'll have. But what's happening is you have a council that's essentially creating policy that does that. But then they're saying, oh, well, we want to create an affordable city. So the fact is you can't have it both ways. Our council wants to do both things. They want to satisfy neighbors that don't want growth, like the guy that wrote in. But then at the same time, they say, oh, we want affordability. You can't do both things.
Okay, Susanna, Roger just said, basically, if you want to be Mount Vernon, go somewhere else. Seattle is a changing city. What do you say to that?
So I've lived in New York City. I was 18 and rented a very, very small micro apartment. And now that I have a family and have children, I have a small single family home. As we grow, our needs, as we, you know, age in our life, our needs change. And so I think it's important that we create space for everyone. And that includes families. We have room to grow in our current zoning. But if we decrease a single family zoning, then we will decrease the supply of the single family homes. We don't have to do that in order to increase multifamily zoning. I moved to Seattle because it is a more livable city than New York. I wanted a home in the city. It doesn't have to be Manhattan. There is some middle ground. There is middle ground between Manhattan and, you know, the boondoggles.
So. Well, I mean, Bill, the thing is that with all respect to Susanna, I mean, her folks shut down single family in single family. A few years back, Tim Burgess led a charge along with Mike O'Brien to kill small lot development in single family zones. In other words, smaller homes. So the folks that are now advocating the things that that Susanna's group is advocating killed single family development in single family zones. So, you know, and she says she wants backyard cottages. Well, they've appealed that and shut that down.
Okay.
Ryan, you know, so the point is you can't say, well, we want more single family homes, but then kill the ability to build more single family homes.
Susanna, do you want more single family? Do you want a more density of single family homes?
No, I'm not saying that we need to increase single family. I'm just saying.
So are you in favor of small lot development on small lots?
Well, I would
prefer 500 square foot with setbacks, 5 feet each side, front yard, backyard.
Okay, I'd like to hear her answer.
Okay, so one, I wasn't part of killing any backyard cottages, and the appeal to the backyard cottages was not to kill it. It was to make the city actually study the impacts of their legislation, which was pretty far-reaching. So, and then secondly, you know, in the Wallingford Urban Village, for example, all of the single-family zoning is set to go to low-rise zone, not to residential small lot. Now, I think a lot of people in Wallingford would prefer, if they did have to have an upzone, for it to go to residential small lot versus low-rise.
I want to get at Susanna's second argument. We already talked about whether more building would make housing cheaper. Your second argument was that we already have room to grow. So, Roger, could we not build more units in the multifamily zones that we already have? Maybe that's build higher, build taller, you know, leave single-family neighborhoods alone. Do you agree that we could build more if we wanted to?
I think we could, but what's interesting is that the single-family neighbors have, through the Mike O'Brien's efforts and the council, him listening to them, have created more and more regulations in multifamily zones. So what you've had is single-family neighbors killing off the ability to build single-family homes in single-family zones. Then they've kind of come out of their zones and killed microhousing, which is where I live, a very small unit. Then they've gone after low-rise, which is the apartments, and forced setbacks and a whole bunch of other requirements. So, again, what we have is we have people saying, well, we want single-family zones, single-family housing, but then they've stopped single-family development in single-family zones, and then they've said, well, grow where we can. But then they've put in setbacks.
So the city could do its growing in existing multifamily zoned areas, but
right.
It's just hard to do.
And so Norm Rice, and back in 20 years ago when they did the comp plan, the original grand bargain was with neighborhoods and said exactly what we're getting to, which is we'll leave single family zones alone, but we're going to grow bigger, higher, denser in urban villages. But the problem is that the neighbors come out of the woodwork and kill dense development in the urban villages as well. So what we have is we have a situation.
For the record, Suzanne is in favor of denser development in the currently multifamily zone areas.
Will you support the abolition of design review? If we can,
I think design review is a very important process.
Well, that kills projects, drives up costs.
Why does design review kill projects?
It costs a lot of money. For example, I just got a hearings examiner appeal from neighbors that appealed a project that was a rezone to go higher in multifamily zones. It went through three iterations of design review. That's hundreds of thousands of dollars.
But don't we have that? Things we want cost money, but don't we have design review in order to have the kind of, if we're going to have building, it should be the kind that we want?
Well, but do we want to add $100 a month to rent for the color of the Hardy panel on a building?
The design reviews is an important process. These buildings will be there for a long time. I've been to plenty of design reviews. The design reviews I've been to say things like there was a backyard cottage next to this multifamily home, and they were going to build the building so close to the property line that the backyard cottage wouldn't be able to open its windows. The backyard cottage, they were going to put the trash bins right outside the window of the backyard cottage. These things come up at design review and they might not be noticed otherwise. It's an important, these buildings will be there for a long time. I'm not saying that there's not ways to create more affordability by making the process better. That could be part of it, but I don't think we should kill design review.
Susanna Lynn is with, isn't your group called Seattle Fair Growth?
Yeah, so we're Seattle Fair Growth.
Yes, Roger Valdez, Seattle Four Growth. And we're debating whether Seattle ought to upzone itself, be less of a single family neighborhood town. Roger, you mentioned the color of a Hardy panel, the design review adding to the cost of units. But couldn't that be an important compromise? One thing I'm pretty sure I heard you use the word ugly, or boxy or something, but I often hear this as a critique of increased development, is it's not just that you get more housing, you get ugly, boxy housing, looks soulless. I get emails like this all the time. Isn't there an area to improve that?
Somebody hearing my voice right now is wondering, how am I going to make my rent payment in June? Do I have that extra $100? Is it worth it to have a pretty building that Susanna and her neighbors approved 5 years ago? Are you willing to pay an extra $100 a month for that? I don't think so.
Susanna?
So I would like to argue that rents will be charged according to what the market will allow. The landlords will charge as high of a rent as they can in most cases to make their profits. I don't think so. What we could be cutting into is maybe the profits of the developers, the profit margin, but I don't think it's going to change the rent. I think that's based on the market.
Let's talk about, Roger said basically if you don't like a denser Seattle, move on. We're a changing, densifying city. Roger, couldn't I put the same question to you? If Seattle's getting unaffordable, if you think it's unaffordable, then you commute in. You can't afford to live in Seattle. That happens. Isn't that just as
well?
I think
if you accept the basic principle of supply and demand, that drives the whole conversation. And when people get here and they have theirs and they have their own little plot of land, and they don't want anybody else to come in. And that's essentially what we're seeing. Is you've got people that are saying, I'm happy, I like what we've got right now, I don't want it to change, and so it should just stay exactly the way it is. And I think that the problem is you have politicians at City Hall and the City Council that want to satisfy that urge that people have, like, hey, it's really nice. And I understand that. But the fact is that if we had real leadership at City Hall, they'd say, folks, things are going to change, not like overnight, but little by little, the city's going to grow and evolve and change. And that might make you uncomfortable. And it might be that you have to pay a little more, or there's going to be some things you don't like down the road, or that look ugly to you, but that are going to house people and give people a place to live so they can be part of our city.
Suzanne, I know you don't accept that more building is necessarily going to make it cheaper to live here, but some people do. And if you did, would you be willing, would you say, you know, I might not like it, I might not like everything about it, but we want a whole range of people to be able to live in Seattle, including people who, you know, are teachers here or landscapers here or whatever it is. And so let's compromise. It may not be the city that it used to be.
You know, I would love to have more affordable housing buildings in Wallingford, and I think most of us in Wallingford would. I think it's important that we notice the difference between more housing and more affordable housing. It's not the same thing. I don't believe it is at all. I believe that we should be building more subsidized housing. We also need to address, you know, people's immediate needs for sure. But I think without more permanently affordable housing, that's what we need. And we need to look at ways to fund that. But talking about the ways to fund it gets to a point that Roger and I agree on. We've been talking a lot about what we don't agree on. But we both agree that the city's plan right now, MHA, mandatory housing affordability, is not the way to get the funding for that affordable housing. MHA exchanges up zones for the developers would have to include affordable units in their buildings or pay an in-lieu fee.
Yeah. And can I talk about the numbers about that? You know, this is the classic definition. If you go to Wikipedia or your Google and look up the word boondoggle, mandatory housing affordability is a boondoggle, big time. They're saying they want 6,000 units by 2025 for $450 million. That would be about $75,000 a unit. The real cost of a building affordable unit right now is about $325,000. So they're underestimating the cost of building those affordable units for fees taken out of market rate development by about, you know, four times. And assuming that we were able to build it for $225 or less than that, you would have to build 1,000 units a year. The height of a nonprofit development about 5 years ago was 450 units a year.
So what do you recommend based on that?
Well, what we should be doing is helping people pay their rent. You know, Lorena Gonzalez keeps walking around citing old, defunct census numbers of 29,000 cost-burdened households at 30% of AMI below. In other words, someone that makes about $22,000 is paying $900 a month in rent. They should be paying about $550. That's $350 a month that they're short. Let's go ahead and tax ourselves $100 million a year. We can pay $300 a month to each of those 29,000 households and eliminate all that cost burden. So if we just paid people's rent, they're already housed, right? They're already living somewhere and they're struggling to pay the rent. We could solve that problem with $100 million a year. So this notion that you know, Lorena Gonzalez says, well, we got 29,000 households that are in trouble, therefore I want $75 million to build 1,780 homes. That's mm-hmm. what the head tax does, or less than that even now. So the problem is that the people at City Hall can't use a calculator, and they keep on saying, we're going to solve this problem by building units, and yet they state the problem as 29,000 cost-burdened households, but they're only going to build, you said it, I think 150 units a year?
I think new construction is around 600.
Over 6 years.
Units
over 5 years.
Yeah. Over 5 years. Anything to add to that, Susanna?
Yeah, so I think it is important to include immediate solutions, such as helping people with the rent and shelters and those sort of things. But I do believe that we have to have more permanently affordable housing, more subsidized housing, in order to really stop this freight train of this affordability crisis and all the homelessness increasing.
Where are we going to put 1,000 units? I mean, they're going to have to go in Wallingford.
We would be happy to have them in Wallingford. Wallingford
where will
is
they
not.
Go?
Wallingford, we have zoning capacity.
Now, for 1,000 units?
Obviously not all 1,000 units are going to end up in Wallingford.
But that's 1,000 units a year.
I'd like to talk about the financing a little bit because we were talking about taxes. So, you know, increasing property taxes has been also increasing the price of housing, and there are other options out there. We used to have something called a growth increment fund, and what this is as the economy grows, a portion of the new tax revenue that is generated from the growth of the economy is dedicated to affordable housing, say 20% of the new tax revenue from the growth of the economy. Growth increment fund is something we used to have in downtown. For some reason, they decided to stop it. But this is one source where you could get new tax revenue without having to increase property taxes. Those increases in property taxes are often passed down to the from landlords to tenants, so it increases everybody's housing costs.
Susanna Lynn and Roger Valdez, you can see that digital clock right up there next to you?
Yes.
Yeah, that says 1 minute left. So okay. It's time for me to say goodbye. Thank you for having this conversation with
Thank
us.
You.
We'll have more, but this is, you know, the premise was Seattle is passing this head tax. Some of it's going to pay for affordable housing units, but the question is, does the city need to do more than that to create more housing units? And we've been disagreeing over whether that would make Seattle a cheaper place to live and how would it affect the city we love. And we've been talking with Roger Valdez, who is with he advocates for more growth. Seattle for Growth is his organization. Susanna Lynn, her group is called Seattle Fair Growth. And that's what it's coming down to. What's the fair way to do this in the city we love? Thank you both.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW, and we'll be right back. It's KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. After the September 11th attacks, there was a man who dressed up as Captain America and started hanging out in New York's Central Park. He did not look much like what we think of as Captain America. This man is thin, has a long beard, he wears a turban. His name is Vishwajit Singh, the Sikh Captain America. And he told me how the whole thing started with a cartoon called Try to Find the Terrorist.
There was a fast-rotating image, and you had to click on these men, bunch of men, white, brown, and you click on them, and you got introduction to them. There was a Muslim man who owns a deli. There was a Latino guy. There was a Sikh man. And there was a white man. So you have a lot of characters and you got introduction to them. What do they do? What is their name? And then you click on the white man, Joey, who committed a hate crime against Iqbal, who is a Muslim guy. And the point Mark was trying to make is Joey, by committing that hate violence, was being a terrorist. That was a profound point because we use that word sparingly.
That idea, who gets called a terrorist and who doesn't, spoke to Vishwajit. He thought, why aren't there more cartoon characters that look like me? And then he thought, maybe I should learn cartooning. So he did.
The first Captain America movie had come out in, I believe, 2011. And I was heading to my first New York City Comic Con that year as an exhibitor to showcase my work. And I said, you know, I need to create a new banner that's going to sort of excite people and bring them to my booth at least. Because New York City Comic Con is big. And I had this poster of Captain America in a turban and beard with a very sort of catchy caption saying, take it easy, it's a turban. Underneath is my long unshorn hair. Let's kick some intolerant ass. And so it caught people's attention. They were like, hey, what's, you know, thumbs up, taking photos. And some people were like, why does Captain America have a turban and beard? And so that started conversations. And a photographer, Fiona Booth, based in New York City, who at the time was doing a photo essay on Sikhs in America, and I was one of her subjects, she was taking some photos and she said in passing to me, Vishwajit, come back next year dressed up as Captain America. And I said, no. She didn't ask me why, but I knew my reasons. I'm a skinny guy. I know listeners cannot see me right now, but I'm a skinny guy. I've been bullied all my life for being skinny, for having glasses on. I've survived a genocide as a young kid. And then post 9/11, my life has been challenging, right? People call you all kinds of names, Osama bin Laden, Taliban, now it's ISIS, go back home. So that it's hard. So it took Fiona almost a year to convince me. And part of that convincing involved another tragedy, the Milwaukee massacre at a Sikh Gurdwara on August 5th, 2012, when a white supremacist killed six people on a Sunday morning. that kind of convinced me to get out of my own way. And I donned, she got me a uniform from Hong Kong, teenager size, and I put it on June 2013, stepped out into Central Park, and I was nervous. I was really nervous, sweaty palm, because I thought people were not going to receive me well in Captain America uniform.
May I ask you, what was going on in your mind the moment before you, for the first time, stepped into the public square dressed as Captain America?
Incredibly nervous. I am naturally a shy guy. I'm not somebody who wants to stand out. And add to that, everything post 9/11. I was incredibly nervous, very aware of my own body and being skinny, and almost felt naked that I was going to go out in this skin-tight leotard uniform. So I felt exposed.
Do you remember the very first person who saw you or who you locked eyes with?
Yeah, I remember. There were a few people who were looking at me, but the first person who engaged me was a tourist who came up to me, of all the people out there right next to Central Park, at the edge of Central Park, and she comes to me and asks me for directions. And I thought it was kind of interesting.
That was the interaction? She asked you for directions?
That was the first one, yeah. I'm like, that's, maybe she felt, hey, I'm going to go to this American-looking superhero. I don't know if she knew Captain America, but she's like, I'm going to ask you for directions. And at that moment, I was giving her directions. I could see people behind her. There was like this group of people who just started kind of circling her, and they were getting their cameras out and they were taking my photos. So that's the first memory I have.
The way you're telling it now, Vishwajit, it sounds like you were mostly welcomed.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it was one of the most amazing days of my life. I felt more than ever in my life that day, like everybody, strangers and others, they embraced me like, wow, you're one of us. You're special. I mean,
you're one of us. You're special.
Yeah.
That's an interesting two sentences to go together.
And in a weird way, I felt like a celebrity too, because I was getting all this attention from strangers. Hundreds of hugs, and people were following me, taking photos of me. And yeah, so it was a strange day. I mean, I still remember a lot of parts of it, and it was a strange experience. And, I thought it was the last day I was going to do this, but, there was something, bigger going on there, and I've been kind of, doing it ever since.
Yes, indeed. In fact, you're in Seattle here with me because you're at the Wing Luke Museum. You give presentations, workshops. What do you want those visitors to know?
I think, when the visitors come in, they'll come in with their assumptions. Some will know a little bit about Six. I want them to come in with that, and they will get to see a little bit about my background, where I was born, Washington, D.C., some photographs. And then they'll get into cartoons. They'll see a lot of cartoons. Some are going to make them smile and chuckle right away. Some will educate them. And some are going to, catch them maybe a little unaware. Some are a little edgy, and they will hopefully shatter their stereotypes, shatter little misperceptions, and some will make them think and ponder and go like, I see, or maybe I connect to what he's saying. Maybe that's partly my experience too. And you'll get to see a few turbans that are also part of the exhibit, because I know the turban is such a mysterious thing for Americans, and I understand it. It's new to a lot of people, and people want to know, how do you wear it? What's under it? Do you take it off at night? Do you shower with it? Those are questions I get from kids, not from adults, because kids are honest, they'll ask you those things. So you have a few turbans you'll get to see as well that are hanging from the ceiling. There are some banners in there that I carry sometimes on my missions to different events as, dressed up as Captain America. I think people will come out of it knowing a bit more about who Six are, but even more importantly, realizing, humor and cartoon art are powerful mediums by which we can all find connections.
Vishwajit, we've been talking about how other people see you. How has your Captain America experience changed you inside?
Well, it's given me a certain level of confidence for sure. The first few times I wore the uniform, I was very nervous. I still get a little nervous, but I have that confidence now that I can put out my body. I've had body image issues all my life. I've been a skinny man, so I'm very aware of my body. I used to wear clothing one size up. My wife had to kind of get me out of that to sort of heal my own body image issues. So in some sense, how it has changed me is I've sort of had this newfound sort of certain level of confidence in a weird, strange way that Captain America alter ego has partly maybe healed me of those insecurities.
What about bias? So many of us are talking about our internal biases, our unconscious biases. What about you? Do you have biases that you struggle with too?
Absolutely. And I found this sort of newfound confidence again as I go to schools and companies and I talk about prejudices. One of the things I'll share in my story before I give people a chance to talk about their prejudices, I'll let them know, look, I grew up in a South Asian family and I learned very early on the notion that light skin is better than dark skin. And you do everything based on that. You marry people, you make friends, you live in certain neighborhoods and how you see people. It took me very long to get out of that notion. My parents didn't have any African-American friends, but I grew up learning and having so many prejudices about African-Americans. And even to this day, I sometimes catch myself. A few months ago, I was in D.C., Washington, D.C., going back home on a train, Amtrak to New York. And before boarding the train, I saw a black man pass me by. He had a paper under his arm, and I could see it's a Wall Street Journal. And for a moment, I thought, that's an odd image. Why does a black man who is not dressed well reading the Wall Street Journal? And I caught myself and I said, okay, that's kind of messed up. But unfortunately, like many Americans, you know, I've soaked in the racism that's sort of built into the DNA of this nation. And I would say that's one of the biggest prejudices that I still have to kind of work on, which is I catch myself judging black people, you know, on a periodic basis. And I consider myself somebody who's very self-aware. You know, I like to believe that, you know, I'm somebody who has very few of those prejudices, but I've come to realize we all have them. The key is to be aware we have them and not acting upon them.
I'm struck by how direct you're being about your own prejudice, because we don't hear that often. So I wonder what you would say here you're an ultimate example of somebody who's putting themselves out there so visibly with the Captain America costume, but in other ways. And I wonder what you would say to a listener who just can't imagine putting themselves out there and being so direct about their own biases.
All of us have prejudices. We all have them. You know, the Pope has them, Dalai Lama has them, we all have them. Our meditation is we need to be self-aware and be honest with ourselves first and foremost and say, look, you want to become a better human being? You have to look at your follies. You have to look in that metaphorical mirror where you can sort of see your own shortcomings. And your prejudices have to be in that list of, hey, this is who I am. I have these conversations in my sessions, you know, and I know they get uncomfortable, but I want to encourage people, you know, look, if we want to become better versions of ourselves, as individuals in society, we're going to have to get honest about the fears we have about each other. And it's because the other stereotype we have is anytime we have a conversation about race, we think that it's only white people who are the perpetrators, right? They're the ones in the wrong. Well, that's not true. I mean, it goes all over the place. But Bill, let me ask you, can you talk a little bit about your prejudices or biases that you have?
Oh, yeah. I profile everybody, Vishwaji. I mean, I have instant reactions. I put people in categories, race, age, dress, politics. My brain is a gut reaction bias machine.
Have you ever acted on any of those prejudices or biases?
That's a good question. Certainly not in a hostile way, but the more interesting question is, who do I not help? How do I influence in ways passive and unconscious, and so I'm sure I act on those biases. I don't have a story for you, but absolutely. And I love that we are talking about this.
Yeah, and I think a lot of our biases are implicit biases, where we're not aware that in very subtle ways they're impacting our decisions, where we buy our houses, where we choose to live, where we choose to do our business.
By the way, I live in a wealthy, mostly white suburb.
Yeah, and that's okay in and of itself. You know, I'm not going to judge you for that. But I think, yeah, a lot of times I think that is part of our meditation is to ask ourselves, first of all, what prejudices we have and maybe how are they impacting our daily, you know, sometimes small and sometimes big life decisions. And even sometimes the notion that you might see a black man in a hoodie and cross the street or clutch your purse a little tighter, you know, that's acting on those biases too. But yeah, I know. Thank you for, you know, being honest with your responses.
Cartoonist and superhero Vishwajit Singh, the Sikh Captain America. Thank you so much for this.
Thank you very much for having me.
You can see Vishwajit's cartoons at Seattle's Wing Luke Museum right now. The exhibit is called Wham, Bam, Pow, Cartoons, Turbans, and Confronting Hate. This is The Record on KUOW. That's our show for today. It's produced by Amina Alsadi, Allison Bruzek, Ajua Jimabrempong, Jason Pagano. Our social media producer is Bree Ripley. Come back tomorrow. We'll take you to Pluto. Alan Stern and David Grinspoon, authors of Chasing New Horizons, Inside the Epic First Mission to Pluto. They're my guests at noon. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for listening. Talk again tomorrow.